Welcome, cycling fans. Do you like coffee? I love coffee. I'm a big coffee fan. I'm kind of a coffee snob. We're going to start off with Nate Dunn's cycling tip, which deals with coffee. So stay tuned for that. We'll hit that right away, and then we'll get into the news and views of the day and some race recaps. If you like us and you've enjoyed what you've heard, you want to make some comments, please do so. Find us on Facebook, Between Two Wheels, the number two instead of the TWO, Between Two Wheels. Also, find us on any of your subscription platforms, iTunes, Stitcher, Podbeam, Overcast.fm, Google Play. You can even, we're going to maybe do a YouTube too. We'll see. Things are out there. We're even on TuneIn. Anyway, stay tuned and welcome, Nate Dunn.
Hi, this is Nate Dunn from Data Driven Athlete with a quick coaching tip. So for years, coaches have advised their athletes to abstain from consuming caffeine for about 4 days before an important race or event. But there's a new study that just came out that suggests that you might not need to do that. And in this study, they compared different groups of caffeine consumers, spanning low caffeine consumers to high caffeine consumers. And what they found was there was no performance difference after acute caffeine supplementation on a 30K time trial relative to how much that participant had consumed caffeine in the past. So in practical terms, it seems like it's okay to continue to drink coffee leading up into your race, but you might want to hold off for about the 24-hour period before that race. So if you want to dig into this topic with a little more depth, you can check out a post over at our blog titled Coffee Makes You Faster on the Bike, Here's How, over at datadrivenathlete.com. Thanks.
Welcome to another exciting broadcast of the Between Two Wheels podcast. This is your host, Tyler Yonke, episode 20. Thank you for joining us today. I hope everyone's had a good week and is getting rolled into their winter training regimens, maybe your time off, some little more time to eat and explore the wonders of weight loss coming up in the next few months. Let's dive right into the news of the week. Recently, a 43-year-old Category 3 French cyclist was caught with a mechanically aided bicycle while in competition. This was the first such incident reported in France. The investigation was initiated by tips into the French police and the French anti-doping agency, the AFLD. Christophe Bassens, a former pro cyclist, took the investigation and eventually the actual takedown of the local race after the older cyclist tried to get away. Oh, and by the way, at the race of his eventual demise, he was in the break with a junior rider, and when the number of spectators at this race seemed to be too high and some suspicious bystanders, he got a flat and quit the race abruptly. Here is what we know. As told to cycling podcast Daniel Freeb, who also translated it from French to English. I'm bringing this out of my head kind of from what I remember of the interview. So don't quote me on this, but go ahead and quote me. One, the preliminary investigation revealed that the cyclist typically rode a bike worth around €8,000 in that range. And then the bike he started to ride when he was being suspected of bike doping was worth about $250. This was an initial tip off of why are you using a bike, such great difference in the cost from what you normally use. Secondly, the bottle in videos that were submitted to Mr. Bassens, Christophe, during the races, he always had the bottle, the one bottle in there positioned in the exact same place, and they had an emblem on there, and it was never moved or never rotated, and the bottle wasn't used. Secondly, there were some strange wires protruding out from the handlebar area that seemed to not be used for anything. And then when Bassens confronted the guy, he lifted up the bike. He said, "Can I feel your bike?" And he could tell that the weight transfer and the distribution of the bike was different than what you would have on a typical bike. Evidently, Christophe Bassens had been investigating this, going into some great length, and then went out and was watching this guy. And he was riding off the front with a junior, a 43-year-old Cat 3. That's humiliating. And basically noticed that there was too many people around, quit the race. They accosted him, or they came up and confronted him. He was trying to drive away. They took the bike, and then the authorities were called, and he was I don't know if he was arrested, but he, the bike was confiscated. And it's an interesting interview you should check out on the cycling podcast with Daniel Freeb when he talks to Bassens. He talks about how this is just something that's a little disturbing to him to go about down this area. He also mentions that he believes that the UCI is not doing enough on the mechanical doping issue. And what he meant by that is that he believes it's not necessarily a problem in the pro ranks, but that the UCI is also not doing what they should be doing to stamp it out. In other words, to stamp out the innuendo and the rumor and the conspiracy theories by that. He believes that you should be able to take all these bikes right after a World Tour race, take them all into, you know, confiscate them all, do a complete breakdown, you know, looking into them as well as you can, and basically ruling out that there's no mechanical devices being used. And he believes that the way that it is with the reports coming out with the little scanner that they have that is not quite doing it right, that there's other suspects, you know, things that could be going on around, and it's leading to more conspiracies. And basically you can thwart this with a better one-time breakdown of this, you know, random, so to speak. So this whole story, this is really strange. It's really one thing and appalling to, you know, to drug your body to cheat, but in the least you have to put in the work to get faster and stronger. I mean, we saw this Icarus documentary, and this guy does this hot route, and he comes and he ends up doping himself, and he talks about it in a podcast he did with Cycling Tips, where he's like, you know, the difference was not that I was able to feel like rocket fuel was in my veins as I went out and trained, but I would do these hammer rides, and the next day I'd come back, and instead of just feeling deteriorated, boom, I'm fresh and ready to go, and I'm able to train again. So obviously you're able to put on the workload. Well, he still got to go out there and do that. This mechanical biking thing here is a sample of a guy just showing up at the race with a completely different engine. I mean, quite literally. And there are always differences in degrees of cheating and nuance, but putting an actual motor in your bike is seriously deranged. I can't even go down that route. It's a different sport. And so if he wants to do, you know, motocross, by all means do motocross, but don't expect the motocross riders to be riding pedal bikes. We just had the Tour of Turkey, and I'd mentioned this on the last episode, episode 19, about how, let me give you a breakdown of what the Tour of Turkey is. First of all, this year it's 6 stages. This event is dating back to 1963, and you look at the overall winners, it's just a smattering of unknown riders from Turkey, Bulgaria, Poland, and here's what some of the breakdown is. Turkey and Bulgaria both have 10 wins each. The USSR, the former Soviet Union, has 7. Poland with 5, Iran and Kazakhstan with 3 each. And anyway, this was first rated a 2.2 event UCI in 2006. That's kind of when it first started too. That's when they were trying to do a little more globalization. And then it was upgraded in 2008 to a 2.1. And now it's a 2.HC on the World Tour. I'm sorry, since 2010, now it's a World Tour race. So it's a bigger event. A lot of riders are going there. I had mentioned before that there was some funny business with some local Turkish riders that had been caught positive. I went back and did my research. That's exactly what happened. 2012, 2013, both of them were on the same team, the Kanyo Torku Seker Sport team, and they both tested positive for EPO, having won the race and then tested positive thereafter. So Ivalo Gabrowski was in the winner in 2012, and then later he tested positive. And I think you look back, he was an older rider, so he had had quite an extensive career. He may have even won this race previously, and then he tested positive for EPO. And then the next year you have Mustafa Sayer coming out, and he also wins the race, and then boom, he gets popped for EPO as well. So both of those two winners kind of lost their way and went down the EPO track sorry to bring this up once again, but this Icarus documentary followed up with an interview, like I just mentioned, of the filmmaker that he does with CyclingTips.com podcast. And his take is interesting, but he does make some points here that the Russian WADA director, Gregory, and the original stance of the Russian attitude towards doping. So his lab, which was associated with WADA, wasn't to detect drug cheats, but rather to help Russia avoid a positive test. He called it the anti-doping society. So as a state-sponsored system to drug athletes, that was the state-sponsored system, was to drug these athletes, way back from the USSR days. And it would be absurd to expect a country whose leader is the former KGB officer to now go straight and narrow and, you know, looking for drug cheats. And so they set up this WADA system, and you see this whole environment with these Eastern Bloc countries and these former and these other countries that are kind of under these authoritarian dictatorships with similar state involvement in their state-run programs. And then they're trying to tie their worthiness of their people to the outcomes of their sporting events. We've seen that over and over again. So the weirdness is you go back to these Turkey, these two Turkish riders and the involvement of those, and you just kind of wonder at what point are any of these teams involved? You know, we've had this with us throughout. I mean, it seemed like there was an issue with some Spanish teams that the state was involved with those. And I don't want to throw dispersions into some other countries, but it's definitely I believe you see this more with the Eastern Bloc coming in. The former Soviet Union have been under control, and what that whole process was and what that manifests to them as a communist nation. You know, they even came out in this documentary that they feel that the bombing of the Ukraine by Putin after the Olympics was spurred on by his confidence and the nationality that was given by all the wins at the Olympics. All right, so let's get off of that kind of a seemingly issue. But okay, so we have the Tour of Turkey. It's got basically one climbing stage and five other stages that are more in the flat section. And you have Sam Bennett of Ireland, the Bora Hansgrohe, comes out and wins four stages. He takes stage 1, 2, and 3, and then he takes stage 5 as well. If you watch any of the previews or the recaps of those, you can see he was actually on course to win stage 6 as well. It was a pretty cool finish. So inside the last 3K, we have a crash, and it takes out as a bunch of teams are all queuing up for the final sprint. And it takes out, it's not in the front section, but it's very close to the front. So all of a sudden this crash happens, and then you have, I don't know, 30, 40 riders that are on the front. You have all the sprinters pretty much still there, and but it does split the field, and it makes it for a smaller front. Then in the last 1.5K, there's a slight rise where Toynes and Bennett and Matteo Pellucci, Bora Hansgrohe, teammate of Bennett, kind of just hit the front, and they start creating a gap, and they get clear. And there's a bunch of 90-degree corners coming in there, so it's like this wacky crit, but it's not it's a start-finish crit rather than a circular. So they just keep going left-hander, and then they do a right-hander, and they do a left, and it's in these tight little roads. They were able to come into the last right-hand corner ahead of the field, these three. However, Pellucci was leading through the last corner, and Bennett was in third place behind Toynes, and he cuts the corner. He kind of dives in because he wants to get in front, or at least into second place, and then hit the final finish, and it's got a slight drag up to it. But Bennett comes around there and maybe a little too hot, and then just rolls his front tire, goes straight down, and Toynes almost hits him, narrowly avoids it, but he's got a gap now to Pellucci, and then he hits on the afterburners and he takes the win. So it was pretty impressive. I guess that's his last race with Trek Segafredo. Now, the overall winner was Diego Luisi. He won the climbing stage up stage 4, giving him enough cushion for the next two stages, which, like I said, came down to bunch sprints anyways, and Bennett would have had, you know, each one going away, taking stage 5 as well. And then Edward Toynes, as I said, he was the only other winner besides Diego Luisi to win besides Bennett. So for the overall, we have Diego Luisi of Italy, the UAE Team Emirates, Jesper Hansen, Denmark Astana Pro Team, Fausto Masnada, Italy, Adrian Sidermec, Bottecchia. And top American was 19th, was Chris Butler of the Caja Real team, his 135 down. So obviously he lost about a minute 35 on that climb and did pretty well himself. The only other real race, I think there's a few of them coming up, but the Tour of Zhangji, October 19 to 24, and it's in China. It's kind of a replacement of the Tour of Beijing, which ended in 2014. The Tour of Beijing was a little interesting. There was some cool scenery on it, and I think Dan Martin won that. I think that's where he got his whole panda bear kind of connection. But the participants of this one should be actually pretty good because it's a Velon-affiliated race, so they usually ensure good Velon teams coming in. It could be interesting. They're trying to showcase some of the... And China can be a very beautiful country, so it'll be interesting to see if it's outside the smog-filled, bad... air quality areas. Anyway, so we will see kind of what comes about on with the Tour of Zhangji. We had some interesting items going on, a few transfer updates and new signings. There was a GoPro video that had helped the police hunt down a driver who drove into a cyclist. I need to look more at this. I just saw some headlines, some people posting about it on Facebook. I believe it was a Jens, his Gran Fondo or some ride he did, and some big truck plows into some people, I think deliberately. And there was some GoPro videos of it, and this, you know, got smattered all over Facebook, and the police ended up being able to track this guy down. I mean, it's pretty nasty. You know, when you have a sponsored ride and the roads are kind of open for this, you know, the vehicles are out there. You still, you know, need to share the road, obviously, but there's a little bit more warning, I think, to vehicles and drivers that there's kind of an event and to be more careful. It's not like you just have, you know, people on a ride and we're out riding with ourselves and some guy comes out and, hey, you know, sometimes cyclists are in the way and they're just a-holes. I mean, we see this quite often, but, you know, drivers are as well. And you know, look, you have a different level of responsibility. You could be more negligent, but the fact that you have a big giant vehicle that can run people down is basically a deadly weapon that you're driving around, whereas a bike, it's not. So it's good to see that guy hunted down. It'll be interesting to see if there's what the defense is on that. And I'll try to follow up on, maybe do a segment on these type of issues. I know there's a lot of them going on out there. And personally, I feel twofold. I feel that and I've mentioned this before, as cyclists, the cars are always the bully, not always the bully, but I mean, they're always the bigger guy. They're always the one that is going to win in a fight if you have, you know, a collision of any type. It's kind of our responsibility, and no offense, but, you know, if you're looking at, hey, you know, share the road, get it, three-foot law, I'm a little indifferent on. Partly because of there's not always enough room for a bike and a car. There's a lot of roads that just don't have a bike lane in it. That doesn't mean that a car shouldn't be giving you that breadth of distance there as well. But to make sure that it's three, and how do you force an actual three? I think that's more of a suggestion, and that's perfectly fine. We also, as cyclists, have a duty to make sure. Well, let me go back to one thing too. How are the roads paid for? I mean, we all say we're paying for those roads, but it's really a lot of it. It's, you know, fuel tax. It's a lot of car licensing taxes. It's a lot of issues that go into the actual people that are on the road that are actually paying for that. Cyclists may not be contributing to it to the same extent that a vehicle is. It doesn't mean that they then own the road. It does, however, mean that that's the primary reason for those roads. If we got rid of the cars, now we do have infrastructure out there, but if we're looking to make new roads, you're not going to be making those on the back of cyclists. That's why we don't have a lot of bike paths. I mean, let's be honest about that. Okay, with that said, the fact still remains, these are big cars and they can hurt you. So it's your duty to be, you know, trying to be understanding. And especially when you're out there all by yourself, you know, it's easy to get a light, it's easy to get a reflector. I'm not a big fan of the reverse mirror, the rear view mirror on your helmet for many reasons. I'm not advocating that, but I am just advocating, you know, there's times to be following the rules. We roll stop signs sometimes, but you know, it depends on that. It's like a perpendicular three-way compared to other things. Sometimes lights don't trigger and it all depends. And you know, it's our duty as cyclists to not to expect the car to obey the law necessarily and to do, but yet have them expect us to. I think that's kind of the safe way to go about it, because in the end of the day, it's just a ride, you know, be on with it and whatever. So we have some transfers out there. I saw Rue had signed with the UAE team, and I also saw where Vinokourov, the owner, I don't know if he's the owner, but the director of the Astana team, was just shocked. He said by it. I don't know why he's shocked. I mean, this is something I knew about this during the rumor was this exact thing during the tour, and that, you know, someone who is Astana signing, because, you know, they're going to leave. Aru is going to be leaving. I think I pretty much, you know, heard that from way back. So, and I knew he hadn't signed. So I don't know that it should have been a shock to Vinokourov. Maybe, you know, dealings are obviously different within the team than what we hear outside. But all he had to do was read a few news stories and he would have maybe picked up on the rumor. Robin Carpenter, he signs a 2-year deal with Rally. It's a pretty good deal for him, coming from, I think he was Action Berman. So a new step up for Robin Carpenter, unless he was with Hincap. You have to look that one up. Mike Woods has confirmed that he signed with Cannondale Slipstream Education First JPEG, presented by Crowdfunding. I don't know what their name of their team is, actually. For 2 years, so he's on there for the 2018-2019 season, which is good. Cannondale Slipstream Education First JPEG, crowdfunding team source. I don't know what they're, they already signed to keep Rigoberto Urán, Alex Howes as well. And then they're bringing some, actually some sprinters, Dan McClay, Sacha Mulledo and Logan Owen are all kind of the sprinty types. Sacha and Dan McClay are more notable for what they could do. Logan Owen is just stepping up to the world tour. So it'd be interesting to see what he does as well. What else we have here? We have some, the UCI came about with some rule changes and 11 big rule changes for the 2018 season. None of them that I saw were really what you would call, you know, notable for the sport itself. It's all just kind of stupid rules relating to, well, here we go. Team size reduction. So that actually is a big one that really is going to affect. We just had the Tour de France route released. It's not like they're saying your team is reduced, but we're adding another team to the race. So they're actually, you know, bringing the race's maximum size down to like 176 riders for a lot of these races, and you know, bringing the actual reduced size of each team. Like the Tour does 9, it's 8. I'm not sure if the smaller tours that have, you know, 6 or 7 rider limits are bringing those down as well. So that'll be interesting. We just had, we just had the Tour de France 2018 route announced, and it does look like a lot of the stages are kind of these shorter stages. They're trying to throw a bunch more of those in the mix, which you throw those in with smaller team sizes, it could make a difference. Tighter regulation on inflatable structures. You've got, you know, we don't need to see the Adam Yates running into a barrier, you know, at the 1K to go, busting up his chances. That's a safety thing. So I'm not sure what the tighter regulation on that is. Let's see. For the next 4 years, inflatables are covered by strict regulations, being equipped with 2 generators, 2 blowers secured for at least 10 anchor points. And so it's a lot of like, it sounds like OSHA is taking over on those barriers. Harsher penalties for holding on to cars. Okay. This, I'll call this the Italian rule. And so a sticky bottle, you know, we've had that for the, but the harsher penalties is actually just a harsher monetary penalty. So I don't know. We'll see if that makes much difference. Harsher penalties for going through level crossings. Okay, so there's another safety issue, and it has to do with train barriers coming down and people riding through it. I know Taylor Finney did that, I think, at the Tour of Britain or one of those races this year and got expelled for it. So what's more harsh than expulsion? I guess it's a more financial penalty. Clear definition on the 3-kilometer rule, which is probably a good thing. Previously, we've had it where a rider suffers a problem in the final 3K of a race, and they want to make sure that you know, they get the same time as the whole group. To get the same time, they need to prove that they were involved in the incident. That's how the new rule is going to be. So as opposed to an accident, as in the other. So I guess a difference in this one is incident versus accident. We'll have to wait to see how that actually breaks down. Rule 6 change. Bigger punishment for finishing outside the time limit. What? I thought the punishment for finishing outside the time limit was you didn't get a race the next day. So I guess they're basically saying they're not going to be holding to these gruppetto ideas. So if you finish outside the time point, here's what they're actually saying. If you're a green jersey wearer or you're a points competition wearer, you finish outside the time cut, they're not going to just do this little slap on the wrist, but they're going to limit or actually start losing all the points from the classification. So that means the green jersey wearer, that's really the big problem here, could be sent back to 0 points if they finish outside the limit on the last mountain stage of the Tour de France. You have I guess the idea is they want, if you're outside the time limit, they can still allow you in, but you're going to have lost your points. I think that's somewhat fair. Hey, you have a time limit, a time cut. You don't make it, and you're in one of these points classifications. You then don't get to reap the rewards of having an extra easier day, and that's relative. I mean, you could be in that because you have, you know, gastrointestinal problems, you know, you crashed the day before, so you're suffering. But for me, it does make sense that you don't get to just sit back and come in much further back than everyone else. And, you know, because sometimes these time limit cutoffs are not, they're somewhat arbitrary. We saw several years ago, Ted King got barely DQ'd from a team time trial that he got dropped from, I think, a wrecked, and then just barely missed the time cut. And, you know, he's expelled from the Tour. And then you have these big mountain stages where there's a group of them coming in minutes past, and they're like, well, we can't cut out, you know, these 93 riders that finished an hour down, so we're allowing them to go. Okay, I'm on board with that one. 7, tighter regulation of podium ceremonies. Okay, so this is one I could probably not give a shit about. I guess they're saying that at the end of stage races, you're going to have the top three shown on the podium. Okay, we'll see if I care more about that at a later date. Number 8, riders cannot wear leaders' jerseys on opening stages. Okay, so you won the tour last year. You're coming in this year as the defending champion. You don't get to start the race with the leader's jersey on stage one or the prologue. That's probably a rule that's in line with how a lot of these riders would want to do anyway. A lot of them have tried not to wear those, simply like Chris Froome's, and it starts with the prologue. He doesn't want to wear the jersey of the tour because he wants to wear his special skin suit that's much faster. And as we know, you know, teams complain that it was 20% faster. All right. 9, compensation for riders cleared of doping offenses. This is an interesting one. So you've been, Samuel Sanchez has his a test positive. You get sacked and your team, you know, doesn't let you race or whatever, and you're pulling your contract, and now you get cleared of that B. Then maybe the B comes back, or maybe it doesn't, but then you go to the court of arbitration of sport and they clear you. They're basically saying past the teams were able to terminate these contracts without any notice or liability for any damages that could occur. Now, if you've been cleared of any wrongdoing, you get to partake back in your contract and they'd have to buy you out and such. So that's a little interesting for the fact that these teams, their whole credibility is been washed away in years past. And now it's, you know, any suspect, and why are you having a positive test at all if you're clean? And then the dirty kind of washes onto the team. So I get their side, but, you know, you got to respect a contract as it is as well. Okay, rule 10, solo winners support cars cannot cross the finish line. Okay, so the guy's up the road in a break, team car's there with him, they're banging on the side, they're yelling at each other, and the car comes across the finish line with him. Okay, I guess there's been trouble with that, but not really seen how that really plays in. 11th, teams need to plan special kits further in advance. So you see this with Chris Froome, like winning the tour, and they have, you know, a special jersey, you know, more yellow in it, and the whole team wants to wear it for the last day. They're basically saying, you've got to give us more of a notice than just the last minute thing. So now they say they have to decide that they're going to basically have 60 days in advance, and when they're going to start the race. There's another thing about a 30-day answer period. Basically, I guess Froome would have to say, I'm going to win the tour in the last day. I want my team to wear this. And so they're going to have to submit it 60 days ahead of time, get approval. And then I wonder if he's not in yellow, if the team still then has to wear, if the team still has to wear it on that day. That would be, that'd be interesting to see. All right. So lastly, you know, there's not a lot going on right this time of year. So I was thinking of reading Phil Guymon's new book, Draft Animals, and maybe doing a book report on the podcast so you didn't have to read it. I mean, I've had a history of being highly disappointed actually with cycling-related books in the past. The problem seems to be the low bar that I've set myself for these books that cater to the specific need of, you know, my cycling material that I really want to consume. This is maybe but it reminds me of the hot coworker standard. I don't know if you've worked for a big company or even a small company, but you've worked at this place and you see a coworker, and you know, this is before I got married. And so, you know, however it works with you, but you're at work and you're there with all your coworkers, and you happen to see this one that just, you know, there's friends, and then you're like, hey, this is a hot coworker, and you point it out to a friend that doesn't work there, and they're like, dude, I'm not impressed with him or her. I mean, he or she is just standard. Well, I think what happens is they're hot by comparison, and they're hot by comparison to the people you work with on a daily basis. And that's kind of my same problem with cycling books. We allow this standard to be lowered because we're so interested in wanting the cycling material. So we end up reading books with doing cycling matter they're just substandard. And actually, there's a lot of substandard books out there. I mean, you go to the library and you go to the bookstore and you could read a substandard book and you're like, hey, this person got published, why not me? So most are not well written, and sometimes that's because the author is the cyclist and maybe he barely knows how to even write out a grocery list, but then they try to write a book themselves and it sucks, or they get a ghostwriter who might not know anything about cycling, and so then it's just some fluff stuff thrown in there, and it's more like, and it's something I just not interested. With that said, though, I've read some stuff from actual journalists, and I've been impressed. I've mentioned Daniel Freeb's book about Eddie Merckx. It's well written. He's a good writer. So before you go out and start, you know, dating the office hottie and spend your hard-earned cash on some drinks and dinner, I suggest you maybe allow me to do a review for you of Phil Gutman's book. But with that said, I actually haven't even bought the book yet, so I don't know what I'm going to do. But I do know I did read Phil's first book, and it wasn't bad. He's a decent writer, but he's no Hemingway, okay? But I did get the impression he believes he's Hemingway, and that bothers me just a little bit. Secondly, his first book has been rumored to have a lot of BS mixed in the pages of truth, so I'm a little torn on that as well. To me, that's a little troublesome, because if he's embellishing on some of these little items, which I've heard he's done from people who are actually in the book, then what is he doing on the major issues? Is he dusting over some of the facts? Is he just embellishing? Is he, you know, compiling multiple characters to be kind of what he wants to take on as his own? Maybe just putting on some makeup and lipstick on a vision so that it makes you look much better than what would appear on the outside. This is always why I'm not ever writing a book of my life, by the way. Well, first, it'd get less interest than this podcast. And second, I'm a little iffy on some of my own life details. Not because it were drug induced, just because when you're living in the moment, everything seems to be one way to you. And, you know, my book would be more of a summary rather than think back 10 years ago, not on something this last week, but 10 years ago of a conversation, or 5 years ago, last year, of a conversation you had with one of your friends that was maybe not so memorable, but it would point into part of your story. Are you going to be able to accurately portray a conversation? I said this, he said this, you know, and witty and funny and some repartee back and forth. No, you can't do that. I could go, oh yeah, I spoke to Kurt last year about power meters. I'm sure it was funny. I don't know. But I can't do that enough to make it in a book. So if you're making quotes, you know, and people are taking quotes out of your book, it's likely not going to be, what's the word I'm looking for? Accurate. All right. Also, Phil's released 3 books by now, and he touts this as his 3rd book. But book 2 was a compilation of his writings from Velo News. Now, I'm a true hater of things like this. I really am. The best of album, just to get another album out there, or maybe to go on tour for a band, is not something I like. My favorite hate, though, is when a TV show, you know, they just throw in the towel for an entire episode. They do a flashback with old scenes and compilations from previous episodes. They're just sitting on the couch talking, and then it flashes back, and it's so lazy. But to actually call it your book, Phil, come on. I don't know. All right, my last problem with this is Phil's recent podcast with Tom Danielson. You can go on Phil Gutman's podcast. You can listen to the one with Tom Danielson. And if you haven't heard it, I suggest you please do so. And I used to be a big Tommy D fan. I was also a big Phil fan. But this listen, it kind of blew my mind. And what blew my mind was how Tom, you know, everything's out there. And he's got his excuses or his answers now, and he's come clean and, you know, da 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 da. But there's pointed questions to him from Phil, which in Phil's, you know, in his defense was very good. But Tom avoids them over and over. And he's like, you know, I don't want to get into all that again. That's already been talked about. Well, it hasn't been talked about in this podcast, and I kind of wanted to know. And then there was some follow-up questions I really wanted to know. And I'm yelling, no, those have not been covered. So for me, that was a problem. And the bigger issue that is, though, you've got Phil, who's got a clean soap tattoo on his arm. That's he definitely goes after. I just saw one of his retirement videos where he tries to get the climb up Flagstaff in Boulder, and he doesn't get it. So he sits there and he complains about Levi Leipheimer being a doper and blah, 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 which is perfectly fine. I'm all on board. But then you don't go and say, well, but see, the difference with Tom Danielson is I know him personally, and he's a good guy. Well, you know what? People know Levi personally. You know, maybe Levi is a good guy too. So the problem I see with even with Tom on the podcast and then Phil is the subjective. Your morals are, everything's black and white except for when it's gray and in your position. And then morals are easily swayed. So the problem here Phil gets put into this box of no gray area and even inked it on his arm, as I said. So then you take the gray area argument out when you're talking, you put it in actually when you talk to Tommy D, but you put in the black and white when you talk to Levi. And his moral compass is perhaps a bit skewed based on his personal relationships, which is fine. But you can have friends that are doing bad things and it's okay to say, no, I don't agree with those. And so if you're going to do that with one, though, you've got to do it with the other. You can't go on Twitter and rip everyone to shreds and in the same time then try to go and defend Tom. And I know Phil's conflicted with this, but maybe the green soap tattoo on your arm wasn't the way to go then. You know, it brings me, and I'm going to get off of this doping shit, but it brings me back to an interview with Dan Martin, who gave an interview with Paul Kimmage back in 2013. Okay. And I found this back again because it was, to me, it was highlighted onto the attitude. So Dan says, I think it's a moral fiber thing. I mean, we were talking about this the other day, but in every report now it says they are not doping because the testing is so good. But the cultural aspect is very much overlooked. I don't dope for the same reason that I don't walk out of a shop with stuff without paying. I've never stolen anything in my life. I've never cheated in an exam. Why would I take drugs? Dan goes on then to say, I think it's also about the need to win. I don't need to win races. I enjoy it. But that's what's most important to me, is to push myself to the limit and just do the best. And if that's first or 100th or not finishing well, then that's what it is. And, you know, this goes also to the Tom D and some of these other guys that felt that they had to dope. You don't have to dope. You know, if I'm in a situation, I'm an attorney, and I'm in a situation where I'm going to be compromised, or I feel like I'm going down a route where, you know, to do something just to make some extra bucks or whatever, but it could take my license away, or I can't go and look at my family correctly, you know, and look them in the eye, or not going to sleep well, I'm not going to go down that route. Why? Because what, I have to? Because I'm an attorney and because I need to make the money? No, because you have some moral fiber behind you. And if you're not going to do it in one situation, you're not going to do it in another. And just for the sporting glory or to get more likes on Instagram or something, it's all bull crap. So that's what we have for today. I got some great celebrity listener comments. So I thought I'd go through some of these. First one, I found your podcast just in time. Since I've retired, I am struggling to find self-worth and a platform where people will take me seriously before I become even more irrelevant. Your podcast shows me I have some distance to go before I am there. Phil Guymon. Oh, thanks, Phil. I don't know if that's underhanded. Next one. Well, Tyler, I'll tell you, I did battle some humongous waves, but you know, just like told the guy on ABC, danger is my business. Signed, Taylor Finney. I didn't even follow that one, Taylor. Okay, and the last celebrity listener comment. I decided to retire to spend more time with my family. But since I found your podcast, I've been wondering why more people don't just do the same and retire. Andrew Talansky. You know, Andrew, I don't know if that was necessary. It seems a little bit harsh. Are you saying it? All right, I'm just going to leave that there. All right, that's all we've got for today. Thanks for joining. Look for us next time. We hope to be out with some more episodes and some more interviews. Thank you very much. Goodbye.